Honorable Steve Swart, followed by the Honorable Lizelle Adams, followed by Dean Smuts. In that order, please.
Chair, thanks. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate the NPA on the unqualified audit. It's good that there is progress being made on the financial accounting side. My concern with the report is that I'm finding it quite difficult to work out the information that I'm looking for. We've got the annual report, and then we've got this presentation that was made to us. And some of the information in the presentation, which is not a document that's properly tabled, it's just presented to the committee. This is tabled in Parliament as required, I think, by the PFMA. Some of the information in here is not in the annual report. And it's quite difficult to work out what's going on. And let me just raise particular issues. I mean, I'm interested in the vacancies of the prosecutors particularly. And I'm not clear, I mean, we're told in the overhead presentation on page 5 that the vacancy rate is 11.89%. But we're not told how many prosecutors there are. This thing on page 4 of the number of posts and the number of posts filled, but they're not just prosecutors. And in fact, the annual report is till the end of, March this year, whereas this figure is September, is a figure for September. So I don't know when this vacancy rate of 11.89, whether that is for the annual report period, whether it's September, what it is. I find a figure for prosecutors on page 120, which is an indication that there are 3,134 posts, and the vacancy rate there, which 2,710 are filled, and the vacancy rate there is 13.5, which is more than the rate given on the overhead. But, you know, it's difficult. That's a key issue. We just don't have the stats. I would have liked to have seen a chart of saying this has been the vacancy rate over the years. I know attention has been given to try and fill the vacancies, and I accept that they are more difficult to fill than the other posts. But then I don't understand why. I mean, the highest vacancy rate seems to be in the admin-related staff, 21% at the end of the financial year. Those should be easy to fill. So I don't understand. I'm not particularly happy with that. Then we're given a whole lot of information, but it's not particularly useful. So if you go to slide 35, which is the grievances and other disciplinary action, it's very nice. It's very interesting. Number of hearings, pending levels, employees suspended, disputes, appeals, etc. But I'm wanting to know how many prosecutors have been dismissed. Not here. There's no outcomes on this aspect. So my concern from an oversight point of view, Chair, is things are clearly happening, as shown on slide 35. But what the outcomes are, and whether prosecutors who are being suspected of wrongdoing or accused of wrongdoing, or members of the NPA for that matter, are being dealt with, dismissed, or given warnings, or whatever, it's just not here. So, respectfully, slide 35 is of no use, I think, to us. It just shows some activity. Whether that activity is working or not is another matter. But going back to the vacancies, if you look at page 6, the provincial directors, I mean, you've got 4 out of 9 actings, acting provincial directors. Mthatha, KZN, South Gauteng and Free State. And I know from when we went to Free State, I mean, that Advocate Du Toit, I think, has been acting for how many years? Can you tell us? 4 or 5 years. Okay. Now, I know you've appointed somebody finally, but when there's an acting, are they paid the full position? Because my understanding is Advocate Du Toit was not. Okay, I don't know what goes to how I asked him that question, so he had to reply. I don't know what goes for the others. I imagine with KZN, I mean the provincial director is Advocate Batoy. Now she is busy performing other functions somewhere else. I can't director, or is he just expected to do the job? And further on the staff establishment, how are we doing in Limpopo and Mpumalanga? We'll get the department, we'll have the department tomorrow. They'll be telling us, DG, just to give you notice, they'll be telling us on how far things are going with the establishment of the Limpopo High Court and the Mpumalanga High Court. But I seem to remember last time we were told that the Limpopo High Court was effectively functional. Now, where is the NPA as far as the Limpopo division? And you anyway have the Toyando High Court, so to some extent, but you don't seem to have made any movement, or you haven't given us any movement around that. Then on the issue of the performance in the courts, I think DG, I'll direct it at you, because you're the public servant responsible for the justice system as a whole. The difficulty we've got, or at least I've got, is the recording system for the court. So if you get stats, when we try to do the monitor what was happening with the Child Justice Act, the statistics from the police and from the NPA didn't talk to each other. I note in the annual report that there's reference to the electronic case management system, which presumably when it's instituted will help. And in the annual report it says that challenges were experienced because the NPA and the SAP could not complete the deployment and testing of the new schemes. There's a whole lot of technical stuff. But the electronic case management system integration is expected to be completed by the end of April 2011. How far are we on that point? Because it's again difficult to work out what's happening. Now, one of the issues I raise every time, and it's a pity that the national director is not here, informal mediations. These figures are pretty large. 81,000 in the district court, or 81,800 in the district court, 1,400 in the regional court for the previous financial year. I note that you include them under finalized cases, not removals, but to my mind they are removals, because there's no verdict of guilty or not guilty. They are removed from the roll. So in a sense, removing them from the finalized cases category will decrease your percentage of finalized cases, and I think that's where they should be. But my difficulty is, what is an informal mediation? And this is the issue I've raised before, and the need for policy, that we don't know what's happening. Informal mediation could be the prosecutor just decides this case is too complicated, tells the complainant, look, sorry, I don't think you've got any chances, won't you agree to withdraw the case? And we really need, given the high number of informal mediations, it needs to be regulated, preferably by legislation, as plea bargaining was done. So I'm not saying it's all legal, I've got no problem with it, but I have a problem with the extent it seems to be being used without any regulation, and from us as legislature performing oversight, knowing what is going on, how many cases, what form of mediation is occurring, because it's not diversion. What is happening in these 81,000 is a lot of cases. What is happening? How is a mediation working? So I'd really want to know those details, and then also where are we as far as policy? Whether it is in the policy from the or directive, I think it's called, from the national director, and ultimately legislation. I mean, Chair, it's similar to the plea bargaining that was happening beforehand. We then, because of the potential for problems and abuse, it was then. Legislation was introduced by the minister to formalize it and protect everybody concerned. That needs to happen with informal mediation, and my concern is I've been raising it now, I think, for 2 years, I think, since informal mediation started appearing. The other was just the other was the issue of sorry, I should have raised it un- under the grievances and disputes. The number of one of the categories that's not here is the number of you've got labor, they're more internal matters, but how many members of the NPA are being charged or facing criminal charges? That's an important figure. We get that from the magistrates because we have to deal with the Magistrates Commission or the disciplinary action against magistrates. But what's happening with those? What's the status of those officials who have appeared in court? And then, Chair, linked to that, the issue of it made it into the media quite substantially. The issue of the complaints against the head of the Special Investigation Unit. And I understand that criminal charges were laid against him. Now, to the NPA, where are those, what's the state of that? When were criminal charges laid? What date? Because I suspect from the media reports that one gets that they were some time ago. What's the status of that investigation? Has it been finalized? Because ultimately the police, it's been laid with the police. The police investigate, they present the dockets to the NPA. The NPA then make a decision. Because I think in that situation, one wants finality. Mm. It is correct that if there are complaints, that they must be investigated. But what one doesn't want is a situation where those complaints lurk along forever. So my question basically is, I'm not sure if they can respond now, is what is exact status? When were charges laid with the police? How far is the investigation? And then who also laid those charges? So if I can have a response particularly on those three issues. But then in short, basically, a problem with the vacancies that we really need. I don't know how much they can respond now, but it's saying basically we need better statistics. The actings, if there can be a specific response on that, why are these actings for so long for the provincial directors, and are they being paid the moment they start acting in the longer term? Because in Advocate Patoya's case, she's gone overseas or whatever, or been deployed somewhere else. Does the person... So I'm not talking about an acting for a few days while the person is on sick leave or whatever, but an acting where there's going to be for a longer period. Do they start being paid as a provincial director? What's happening with Mpumalanga and Limpopo? What is the issue? The questions I asked on the criminal charges against the head of the SIU, and then on the court progress information. I suspect if we looked at police statistics, they would be different. When is this electronic monitoring system coming into effect, management system coming into effect? And then a problem with the informal mediation. Can we get details of these, it's nearly 100,000 cases, and when is it going to be regularized, either in the form of a national directive and then legislation?
All right, that's quite a bit. Points raised by Mr. Jeffrey, because if I allow other members, you're never going to remember all of them, even though you take notes.
Let me start by apologizing for the report, perhaps, on the discipline not being all that you would like to have seen in there. I think we will learn from that and definitely in future try to provide you with more information as required. We just basically, in terms of that, what is in the annual report. The annual report is a template prescribed by National Treasury. You are only allowed to report, or you're supposed to only report in terms of what they require you to do. Specifically in terms of performance, we've added to you for more information in terms of what we collect. But in the annual report, you get audited on it. You are only supposed to report in terms of the strategic objectives contained in your annual plan of the organization. That's why it's limited to those areas which we reported on, and that is why we're providing a bit more information to you so that you can understand more about the stuff that happens behind it in terms of the figures. If I can start by the acting, there is a DPSA provision that indicates that a person can receive an acting.
I mean, your performance is measured on the success of cases. Your information on the cases is extremely sparse, to say the least. And it actually is very difficult to gauge what is happening. So I'm afraid I don't buy that argument, that you don't have to, well, maybe somebody thinks this is adequate for your annual report. But in terms of measuring whether you are succeeding with finalized cases, particularly, I can't, it's insufficient. And it's weird stuff, like you go into the detail of disposal of TRIO crimes. Now, maybe TRIO crimes are a particular objective, but then at least give us details of all other crimes, the same detail that you've got for TRIO.
We take note of those comments, and we'll see where we can. Obviously, where we do collect the information and we have it, we can look at how we can include it, where there's an audit trail in terms of that. If I can start then with the acting allowance, there is a DPSA provision where a person who, as you've indicated, for not a short term, where you are acting in a position for a longer term, not for 2 days or 3 days here, you're just out of office, but for a longer period, can be paid an acting allowance. But there is also a provision that states that if it's longer than 6 months on the SMS maybe need executive authority, and it cannot be longer than 12 months, otherwise it's irregular expenditure, which of course we have to avoid. So we cannot pay for longer than 12 months. In terms of Mr. Du Toit, he was paid acting allowance for 2 years. We had to stop that now recently because of the audit finding relating to irregular expenditure. I cannot answer around the filling of that vacancy. It's not within my control. It is a presidential appointment that needs to be made in terms of that, which has now been made. So yes, it is a sad situation that a person is only paid for a short-term period while he's expected to act for a longer term.
Advocate Batoy, how long is she going to be away for?
Advocate, if I can get to Mr. Molochwa's situation, Advocate Molochwa has been, well, in June, had acted for a year, and was paid an acting allowance up to that year. There, she is supposed to come back. Before that, there was somebody else acting. So he only acted for that period. He was paid for a full year. This last period would be irregularly continued to, so the options the organization has is to rotate. Then to say you cannot act any longer because of the DPSA provisions, because she only comes back in December. We'll have to see what she's going to do, whether she'll apply to extend that or not. For that period, he was then approached and was indicated to him, do we rotate or, you know, are you prepared to continue to act without an acting allowance? And he indicated that he was prepared to continue to act until Advocate Batoy came back at the end of the year for the remaining 5 or 6 months without an acting allowance. In terms of Advocate Kanyili in the DPP office in Joburg, for the year that she acted, she was paid an acting allowance as well. She's now recently been appointed. It was just the last 2 months where her acting allowance was not paid, but similarly, she had also agreed to continue to act without being paid an acting allowance. It is not the ideal situation. We absolutely agree on that. And it is better that a person, if you're required to do this kind of work, that you are paid an acting allowance. But similarly, we have got to also ensure we comply with the DPSA provisions.
When does Advocate Batoy come back?
She is supposed to be coming back late November.
This year.
Yeah, I mean, I think my question would then be, what are you going to do to change it? Because you've got 4 out of 9 actings as head. I don't know what other categories it applies to. Maybe these posts do take longer to be filled. But then, one would think you should need to make representations to, I don't know if it applies to the department. We can maybe deal with it tomorrow, but I would have thought you should, I mean, particularly in the case of Advocate Batoy, where obviously she's, you can't fill the post because it's not vacant. She's just not there. She's been seconded somewhere else. And this thing of then making them rotate doesn't seem to me to make much sense. It's better to have a person there taking the decisions and performing the functions. And so there should be some kind of special permission that can be granted by the DG or somebody. I mean, I understand it's not your rule, but then are you going to make representations to try and get the rule changed?
The process to be followed is that the VPSA needs to be approached, and we are in the process of preparing a memorandum to go to them to request them to see whether they will in these circumstances. It will only be the Inspector of Advocate Monotro because the other posts have all been filled. We are, because of the fact that it does lead to unfairness, we are trying wherever possible to reduce the need for acting appointments. So we're trying to fill those posts as soon as possible and otherwise also deal with the fact of not having to have somebody acting in those positions. So in our top management, as I indicated, it's been a significant improvement. As of now, there'll only be actually the TOIS position that remains where we have somebody acting. In terms of the vacancy rate, if you look at the DG's report in the beginning, she does indicate the prosecutorial vacancy rate of 12.7%. If you look at the figures on page 120, we have broken it up in terms of categories. So for prosecutors, there is the advocates, which has a vacancy rate of 8.4%, and then there are the prosecutors that have a vacancy rate of 13.5%. And then the average then is 12.7 for those two categories in terms of that. And I do apologise for, I can't change the tables, but and we did put it in the beginning, and perhaps my report should have given more detail around the numbers of prosecutors that we currently employ and the actual number of vacancies. We just indicated right now what we've done to reduce it. In terms of the administrative staff, I agree. It was a huge vacancy rate at the end of last year, but we had a moratorium on the filling of vacancies of most of the admin staff. We decided not to fill it while the situation around the integration was dealt with. This has now been decided that there will not be an integration, the draft bill, etc. So for that reason, we're focusing on filling those vacancies. And I do agree, it is easier to fill the post and administrative component, and we have made huge strides in filling those posts. There are one or two where we are struggling to get suitable candidates, but we are looking at alternatives in terms of that. But it is a matter which we are addressing, and it is easier to address than the others. In terms of the Limpopo and Mpumalanga, the courts that have been created there, we are in the process. We have already shortlisted and interviewed people for those posts. The exact numbers of who has been filled or not, I can provide you in a report next week to show exactly what progress has been made there. There is difficulty in Mpumalanga around accommodation. In Limpopo, as you already indicated, we do have a court in Soyondo.
Same answer as last year. And what I don't understand is that it was quite easy to establish a Gauteng North and a Gauteng South High Court and prosecutorial divisions. I don't understand why it's so difficult to establish a Limpopo High Court and NPA. Maybe just that you can, while the whispering is going on, that you know there's not a great enthusiasm for the NPA to have people in or for staff members to be based in Polokwane. I don't know if that is the problem, presumably Polokwane and Nelspruit.
Why would that be?
Well, people want to be in Joburg.
Oh, okay. Is that the reason?
I know there were problems with the Northwest where prosecutors. I think that's been resolved now that the Northwest High Court deals with the jurisdiction of the Northwest province, not just the former Botswana. But I had heard that was a few years ago that there wasn't eagerness on the part of members of the NPA to move to Mafeking. The same problem applies to Polokwane.
There were some concerns or some difficulty around existing staff to move from the offices to those areas. So what we've done is we've actually advertised those folks. And when we advertised them, we did get a good response. And that is how we've decided to deal with it. And as I said, we already have shortlisted. We have already interviewed. We are in the process of filling those posts. And I will be able to provide you with the details of the numbers. In terms of the people charged in the MPA criminally, and the question of how many prosecutors were specifically discharged. In terms of our annual report, we did indicate that there were six people that were discharged. That is on page 1,538. The number of dismissals is indicated there as being 6. And then also in terms of how many people were given written warning, verbal warning, etc., etc. But how many of those of the breakup between prosecutor and corporate services staff, that I haven't got for you yet, but I can. We do keep that data at the office. I just didn't bring it with. Which I apologize, and we can provide that information to
you. Does dismissal indicate prosecution?
No. This indicates that we had a formal disciplinary hearing, and the sanction that we decided on was to dismiss the individual.
But Mr. Jeffrey's question was relating to how many were prosecuted.
Yes. In terms of how many people were prosecuted, our data is, we have a database at the office in terms of how many of NPA officials are currently charged. We've got actually a database that also would indicate disciplinary hearings, everything relating and investigations, both internally and externally by the SAPS. Did not bring it with me, but I can provide it to you.
Any other
questions on the head of the SIU?
Yes.
Somebody supply that to us.
If Advocate Engelbrecht doesn't, who does?
I think, Chair, what is clear, we have no idea what is happening, because I think what is important for us is that maybe when we do go back, we'll need to establish how far the case has progressed. That is the only response I can offer now with regard to the SIU, to the investigation. It's the inquiry as it's made by the Honourable Member.
You see, when we said things we said right at the beginning of this meeting, we anticipated that this would happen. All right. Okay. We'll have to live with that. Can that be a written response? And if necessary, we'll need to follow it up with an engagement. Okay.
It's ECMS and informal mediation.
Thank you. So with regard to informal mediation, I do agree with the sentiments that the Honourable Member has raised, that really the figures are too high for a process that is not really regulated by statute. What we do have, though, as an internal measure, are policy directives. I know that for effect now that we have submitted a revised policy directive to the NDPP. They are currently before him for decision. We also have guidelines that are in the various magistrates' courts that prosecutors can then use. With regards to whether there are moves really to have this regulated in terms of, I'm sure it's something that we can discuss in the various stakeholder meetings. Together with the other roadways that are involved. Thank you.
Maybe if we can look, obviously the directives that are with the waiting for the NDPP's approval, I mean those we shouldn't be asking for until they're approved. It's not fair. But the guidelines that are with the magistrates' court, can we get copies of those? And then can we get the directives once they have been approved to see? And can the issue be looked at? Can we also get a breakdown? I don't know what the guidelines are, but what is happening with these cases? You obviously can't supply it now, it'll just be anecdotal. But what is an informal, presumably according to your guidelines, you know, is there any compensation? Complainant agrees to withdraw because they'll be paid some compensation. What is that a category? But just what, yeah, basically can we get some kind of breakdown of all these figures?
That could be done.
Thank you very much, Chair. Excuse me. The issue of ESEMS is one of those things that I will be able to give a more formal response tomorrow, but I can clearly indicate the process and agree with the member that the statistics are a bit of an issue within the cluster, so that we have noted. On the 14th of September this year, our systems, IMS and all the related systems that deal with issues of criminal justice nature. Two weeks before then, which was somewhere in August, I had met with the IJS board that deals with just the development of systems. And I cannot recall the exact deadline from that meeting, but I think the NPA representative at that meeting had indicated that they are going to start using the system. It's developed, but they are going to start using the system at the beginning of the new financial year, which is this coming financial year. And there had been delays in that process. So, but I would like an opportunity to confirm the information and then respond to the question tomorrow when we deal with our own annual report. Thank you very much, Chair.
I think they've covered all your...
Yeah.
Honourable Debbie Chef.
Mr. Chair, I have quite a few issues, so if too many, please stop me. Yes, I want to reiterate, well, first of all, what you said yesterday, where we actually shouldn't be congratulating departments for getting unqualified audits. That should be the norm, but given the NPA's history, I think congratulations is in order, and I would like to reiterate that. My concerns are, first of all, page 11 of your report, your statistics regarding withdrawals of matters from the roll. How can you have almost half, in fact more than half in some cases, of matters withdrawn from the roll? I mean, it's really horrendous. When you look at the statistics of what comes in from the police, then it's only a part of that actually gets to court, and then half of that is withdrawn. What are the reasons for those withdrawals? I see your statistics. Some were struck from the roll. Why? Why were they struck from the roll? 17.3% were struck according to your report. 42% were removed as a result of being withdrawn. Why? For what reason? And then there's a 13% that not accounted for. What happened with those? Why were they then enrolled? Because you then refer to on page 13, or I think it is, 12 actually, that you've got a better screening of cases. If you've got a better screening of cases, then why are so many are being withdrawn from the roll? My bigger concern, as I indicated earlier, is the shambolic state of your sexual offences statistics. I don't understand, I'm now even more confused than at the start of the meeting. You say on page 17 of your report that the NPA commissioned research to determine whether the performance information for the dedicated sexual offences courts related only to sexual offences cases. It indicated that most courts were not solely dealing with sexual offences matters, and that you've therefore taken a decision not to report any further on this data. Now, on that presentation, I see there's a figure. In the annual report, it says not applicable. And now, suddenly, it says 68%. Now, what is it? There's a very good saying that says what gets measured improves. There's no way that we can deal with the state of sexual offences in this country when you don't even know what it is. And this has been going on now how long? And it's still not improved. And now you have to do research to find out what your statistics mean. How can it be? Secondly, you're saying you haven't got money. And I have to say I was very impressed to see that you saved something like 1.3 million rand on your telephone deal that you've done. I think that's an excellent initiative. But then you're going to spend 1 million rand on a double-page spread advert for the NPA. With greatest of respect, the NPA has got a captive market. You don't need to promote yourself. The best promotion for the NPA is getting successful prosecutions of crime. So what is 1 million rand spent on an advert for? Well, you know what Mr. Simulani looks like. It's really not necessary to promote him. Page 44... Your ECMS again. I mean, I've been hearing this since I practiced, and that was a long time ago. I mean, we were also excited about 12 years ago when we heard that they were going to get all this lovely integrated management, it's going to stop corruption, attorneys can see where the dockets are, nobody can get access unless you have a password. How much longer is it actually going to? And what I really want to ask you is, how can you say the scheme did not cater for multiple accused per case? Who is running this program where they don't even know that you get more than one accused per case? And why is that person there, and what are you doing about getting somebody there who actually knows how the system? But it's just really crazy. I really want to know, I've heard what you said about prosecutors not being able to get people. Why? Do you know, have you had any indication as to why it's so difficult to attract people that we need to attract and fill those vacancies? Do you know why, and, you know, are there any programs in place to try and try and make it more attractive for people to come. Your expenditure on page 64 of your report, the Audit General's report, the accounting officer did not immediately upon the discovery of fruitless and wasteful expenditure report to the Treasury. Why not, and what's been done about it? Can I also please know on page 87 your staff written off? There's a amount of 701,000 rand staff debt written off. What is that about, and why was it written off? I'm also very pleased to see that you have now made steps to recover amounts from people who don't pitch for appointments in flights. I think that's also commendable, given last year's wastes on that respect. And there's one question, two more. It's not your successes with the witness protection program, but have there been, and do you have any statistics relating to people who may be witnesses in criminal cases who are not in the witness protection program, but who have been killed or attacked? Do you have any data on that? And if so, maybe we need to try and collect some from now on. And just on the Justice College, you said quite a few times you're relying on Justice College. My information is Justice College is not functioning until it gets approval from the Deputy Chief Justice, because SADJ is not working. Shaking your head, please tell me, is it working? Are you getting people? Are there? Because I know a lot of courses have been cancelled already this year, but are your prosecutors getting regular? Is it? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That is.
Okay. There are really many reasons that lead to the withdrawal of cases, but from what we can establish is that it's particularly in the High Court. Cases are withdrawn primarily because maybe the witnesses have passed away, or the accused are suddenly untraceable, or because as we know that the cases that come in the High Court are cases that ordinarily have been investigated in the lower courts. They are from the lower courts, from within the lower courts. It comes to a particular advocate who then makes a decision that he cannot proceed with the prosecution of this case to such because of maybe the witnesses have deviated materially from what they had said before. So, but we take note of the fact that really those should not be justifying reasons, but those are the reasons that we currently have that create the withdrawals in the High Court. Ordinarily, we accept that we should not have a high rate of withdrawal in the High Courts, but in the lower courts, as long as we do not have sufficient and skilled resources to do a better screening, we will continue to have kind of withdrawals, because sometimes the suspects that are brought by the police, they've already been arrested at the end of the day, and because then the prosecutor realizes that there's no case, then he is bound to withdraw the particular case, not because there wasn't any time to screen the case before the police has effected an arrest, which is why then that leads to a withdrawal. In areas where we have noticed that, in areas where we have got experienced prosecutors who are really performing the screening, we have a very much less rate of withdrawals. Thank you.
What point do the, I don't know what you call them, advocates, but they're NPA advocates, what you call them, the prosecutors in the High Court, what you call them? How do you distinguish between an advocate and another advocate? I mean, a private advocate. State advocates. Who could be doing civil matters too, but anyway. At what point do they look at the docket? Do they look at it after it's been referred from the regional court, or do they look at it before? Because if they're looking at it before, then maybe they should, and that would then reduce the number of withdrawals.
I agree.
I wasn't clear which system is working. When I was saying, are they looking at it before, I was getting body movements from the NPA that was happening. But then there shouldn't be, then you shouldn't have a withdrawal problem in the High Court if that's happening. So it would appear as though it's not happening. So which is it?
The process that we follow is that when it's actually in the district court, the person appears in a case that should be heard in the High Court. We actually get involved in it. They notify the DPP office very soon, and it's either guiding the investigation or monitoring closely that it gets it. But unfortunately, when cases do get to the High Court, things do happen. Accused dies. Your main witness dies. It's unfortunate. It's something that is happening on a more regular basis now than was happening years ago. And sometimes a main witness disappears, is no longer available, or an accused is out on bail and runs away and doesn't come back. Obviously, that doesn't get withdrawn, but I mean, there are reasons. But we are concerned about that figure. We agree with you that if we are managing those cases, we shouldn't be seeing a high withdrawal rate on those cases or having long periods that those cases are on the court roll.
But can I just follow up? Sorry to interrupt. How can you have an accused who's untraceable? What are the police doing? And what I'm hearing is that a lot of the cases are withdrawn because there's no case. I mean, there again, we come down to police. Are you interacting with the police often?
We do, Honourable Member, interact with the police frequently, but, you know, there will be always problems of skill to a certain extent, which is always a problem. So this is why we're having this problem of having, for example, the kind of cases that gets into court and then they are withdrawn because probably sufficient evidence has not obtained so as to warrant a prosecution. Those things do happen. But we are working closely with the police.
It was just a follow-up, eh?
Yeah, it's a follow-up. I mean, you see, the problem with the withdrawals is that you can end up with a person who got arrested sitting in custody because they can't afford bail for some time, and then it's discovered that actually there's no case, and then they get let out after months or maybe longer. Now, with the district court, I mean, the police are not prosecutors. That's why the NPA are there. But what I would like to see what I'd want to know is whether you've looked at it, and if not, can you look at it and give us a response? Is there any accountability on the senior prosecutor at a district court for the withdrawals that take place over a longer time? So a case that is withdrawn after having been on the roll for maybe more than 6 months, should the senior public prosecutor, you still have them?
Yes, okay.
Should the SPP not have to account for why the case was withdrawn? Obviously, you know, the NPA can't be held responsible for the police arresting and then the matter going to court and they look at the docket and say, no, this shouldn't have proceeded. But then on the High Court, I think I'm not happy with the response that, oh no, it is factors. I mean, the High Court would not be, there's no case. The evidence is not strong enough. High Court would be accused has died, and all witnesses cannot be traced. Can we not get a breakdown of this 175? What are the reasons in different categories? So we can see if that is the factor, or if the reason is that the case was not strong enough, which should have been picked up before the matter was referred. We can then start looking at that, and then I would have thought there should be accountability on the relevant prosecutor or advocate for why they didn't pick it up before. And obviously you can make a mistake, so one or two is fine, but when you start getting on to more than that, then there's a systemic problem.
Mr. Swart, did you have a slip?
Yes.
If the focus is on getting a high conviction rate, and bear in mind that if you start right at the beginning with the police, and they almost, that's 2.5 single figure successful prosecutions of about 6, 7, 8%. Now the question is, if there's pressure on prosecutors in the district courts and that on conviction rates, is there not a tendency then to nolle prosequi as much as possible, withdraw, so that you then are going to succeed in high conviction rates? Is it where you've got these massive volumes? And I know, I was a prosecutor many, many years ago. So I would never have done that, of course. No, but you've got to just bear in mind the pressure that is on one to produce the goods and to produce the conviction rates. And that can, it must clearly, and if you don't have quality control from your control prosecutor and higher up as to checking, and it's not easy. I think you do, you know, there is remarkably good work every day that's going on, but the concern is the regress, the case is finalized as we see. And it ties in exactly with the concerns High Court, why those particular cases at that level being withdrawn, but then it goes further down. And it's an issue which, you know, I raise every time the department comes, starting with the word go. So I think that is something we need to look at. I'm sure there's no easy answer, but one's got to look at the motivation and quality control as to checking those dockets, as to where are we losing. We've got the battle against crime. There's a lot of pressure on the police. There's a lot of pressure on the prosecutors. Show conviction rates, but it's a balance, because now if they're prosecuting too many cases, then it's, which are dubious with witnesses, but they might get a conviction, that their conviction rate might come down, then we'll be on your neck for the conviction rate. But on the other hand, if they then withdraw, then where they are dubious, then of course we're saying, but you're withdrawing too many cases. So it's almost a double-edged sword, but it's something we should, I appreciate the difficulties that you face. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's why we've got him on the committee.
If I can just deal with the other questions that were raised, in terms of the 1 million spent on the editorial, it was a specific focus on Women's Month and what we were doing about gender-based violence, how we were addressing it. But I take note of your comments about the expenditure. Unfortunately, this kind of stuff is very expensive, so I do take note of it, and it's something which we'll take back and look at more closely in terms of monitoring our spending in this regard. The 701,000 you speak about that was written off, this is relating to bad debt, and it's debt that we can't recover. We've received opinions on this. A lot of it is debt that has prescribed, and it is processes that weren't perhaps working as well as we would like it to, and it has received focus in the current year. We're looking very closely at improving our loss control and our loss investigation capacity so they can deal with the cases quicker, so we can make a decision about recovery.
What was it for? What kind of thing?
It's no-show, a laptop that may be stolen from you, which is this, you might have been negligent in terms of leaving it somewhere and then they steal it from you. Your telephone bill might be over our limits that are very strict. It's that, those kind of things that we're talking about. Right now we've implemented a policy that if it's a no-show or you go over your limits, we don't discuss it with you, we just take the money off of your salary. And then you can come and debate it later. So we have put we've implemented processes to reduce that debt that we do have. Sometimes also staff overpayments that can happen. But this month it was written off is debt that's no longer recoverable. People that have left the organization or amounts that have prescribed in any con. But we are monitoring that very, very closely to reduce that. It's an area of concern.
Just on the issue, people have left the organization, it doesn't mean because someone's left the organization that it's not recoverable.
But if you can't recover it, if it's prescribed. And so it relates to that too. We didn't recover it on time, then now they finally find out where the person is, but now it's prescribed. So it's that kind of stuff. But we are dealing with it. In the current year, it's an amount which we monitor on a monthly basis. It's a figure which we look at, and we're very careful about writing off. We're reducing it annually, and we are recovering a lot better and a lot quicker. In terms of not reporting to National Treasury, the finding that you relating to irregular expenditure and wasted expenditure, that was also a process flaw which has been addressed. We are currently, as we uncover possible irregular expenditure or as we decide it is irregular expenditure or wasteful, it is immediately reported through DG to National Treasury. So that process has been put in place and it is addressing. We are confident you will not find that in the current year. Why is it difficult for us to address our vacancies and to attract? When we advertise, we actually receive a huge amount of applications. There are a lot of people applying for the job. Our problem is that a lot of people don't meet the minimum requirements of the position. We have people applying for jobs as prosecutors that don't have a degree, that are working as cleaners, that are working as messengers, that are working as administrative people. So the numbers itself don't relate to what there is. But then the biggest problem is that when we do shortlist them, they don't fare well in the interview process, because the interview process also tests your practical knowledge, not just your theoretical knowledge. So it is a challenge that we're experiencing. We have tried this year to see if we can set some targets around getting people from outside, and in the current financial year we're doing a lot better. We are appointing more people and trying to find. We've also developed a bridging program, and that is for people higher up, where if you come in and you don't meet the total requirements, we put you on a bridging program with mentoring and coaching to upskill you so that you are able to. So we are really trying our best to address this area.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the issue of people that have left the organization, of course, we do recover from them, but I think circumstances, sometimes you look at the cost-benefit analysis, sometimes recovering that money is not worth the cost that you are going to incur, so we are also mindful of that. Then on the issue of the workings or otherwise of the Justice College, I just want to confirm and put it on the record that the Justice College is indeed working. It is rendering training, particularly to the prosecutors. We will be tabling tomorrow an indication of the training that we have offered during the year under review and in the current year. The issue that I think the member is referring to is the functionality of SAJE, which is the Judicial Education Institute, and that is the one that has that we are busy dealing with to help it and take off the ground. I just want to come back to the issue of ECMS, because perhaps I know that I was understood, but I just wanted to explain it slightly differently. One thing that I will agree with is that, and this is fact, is in doing the review, because the JCPS class that did the review, we said 10 years later, okay, maybe 6 years later, when the ECMS, the integration, the criminal justice system integration, when we started receiving money for, we have not managed to integrate, and I really want to speak to this issue, is each of the cluster departments have built systems. The one thing that has not happened is the systems have not started talking. So what we were saying was, what are the 5 topmost things that we can do to ensure that there is the integration, rather than us now building these towers that are not giving us the integration that we are looking for? And so that meeting, the meeting of the 14th of September, and I think the previous meeting must have been on the 20th, on or about mid-August, we were doing just that, to say we are embarrassed by the fact that this thing has not happened, but we now must ensure that it happens, because it's almost 2 billion rand later that we've been building all these castles and they have not been speaking. And so that's the issue that we are addressing, and that's the issue that we would like to come and present once we've nabbed the problem in the bud. In issues of accountability, we're included in this discussion, governance accountability around the usage of the money, but also a more closer oversight. So we've brought this committee closer to the JCPS cluster. It was a subcommittee of the JCPS cluster, so we've brought it. It reports directly now to the JCPS cluster, so that we know what the IJS program is doing. But what we've also done is we've issued a resolution that each of the JCPS cluster DGs make the ICMS integration their EXCO agenda, so that each one of us can see this thing as and when it happens, whether we are spending or we are not spending on the integration, how much are we spending, are we getting the results. I think, and I must admit this, it's really been very far out of sight for us, and we are trying to bring it back in our line of sight. And I just needed to clarify that. Thank you.
Section.
Honourable Chair, I didn't seem to capture the question was asked by the Honourable Chair with regard to sexual offences. Can you please repeat the question?
My concern was that in your report you say you aren't going to give us any figures regarding sexual offences because you did some research about it and you discovered that the statistics are not reliable. And then on your presentation you said 68% conviction rate. So now what is it and why are you not giving us statistics and why does it say something different in your report compared to what you're telling us today? That's my question.
I think Karen will answer that question.
Yeah. You will note that if you compare the figures that we gave you of the conviction rate at the courts instituted the Delicate Care Centre and those of the dedicated courts, which were dwindling. The dedicated courts, at the last time that we counted them, was 42. And every month it was getting less and less and less. But the conviction rate was getting better and better and better. It was going to about very close to 73% at some stage at the end, at the time which we looked at it closely. The head of SOCA then raised the question around whether the reporting at the dedicated courts, because at that stage we were aware of the fact that the judiciary was leaning towards generalization rather than specialization. And she raised the question around whether the data being reported from the sexual offences courts was in fact only sexual offences cases or whether there were also other regional court cases on those court rolls, because the figure was getting very, very close towards your normal regional court conviction rate. It should be more or less stable over the years. So for that reason, based on that question, we commissioned a research. The research then confirmed her suspicion relating to the data and was indicated to us that in very, very few of those dedicated courts, they were only doing sexual offences court cases. So therefore, the data was contaminated. And you cannot then present contaminated data in your annual report because it's not correct. So we've given you the figure of what we had, knowing now in our presentation to you, the NDPP felt that you should at least know what the figure was, bearing in mind the fact that we are aware that that figure is not reliable. It cannot stand the scrutiny of an audit because we are aware of the fact that not all those courts were only dealing with sexual offences cases. But to allay your fears, we regard sexual offences as a critical area. In our current annual plan that was presented to you, there is more than one indicator specifically looking at the sexual offences conviction rate and the throughput of cases from the TCCs to our courts. So what we're doing there is instead of just measuring the conviction rate at the dedicated courts, we have actually asked every prosecutor in the regional court and the high court where they do sexual offence cases to report the performance information on every single sexual offences case. So right now we can give you data relating to every single the total figure, not just the 42 or the 45 cases. So we are collecting that data, and when we do present our quarter one or quarter two figures to you, we can show you that to you. That's what we're collecting right now. We also then still look at what is the conviction rate of the court being to TCCs, because you want to make that comparison. You want to see what's the value that the TCC is adding to you. So we do collect that figure, and then we look at the throughput from your TCCs to your court. So, you can rest assured that it is a critical focus area for us, and we're also looking at the numbers that are being done in those courts. It's not just good enough to do conviction rate, because you could be getting an 80% conviction rate on 10 cases when in the past you're getting a 60% in 100 cases. So we are looking at the numbers as well. So we're getting better data. It's a wider, it's no longer a sample, you know, it's a small group. It is the total number of cases being dealt with in all the courts in the country.
Just one follow-up quickly. How do we then compare how we're doing compared to what was before? How do we compare how we're doing, progressing or otherwise, compared to previously?
You can't, because it's an apple and a pear that you're comparing. I think with all the caps with witness protection, you've got the same thing. But what we do is we do look at least, we are looking at what it was in a dedicated court compared to what it is now. In fact, we're noticing very interesting enough that the conviction rate is higher than it was in the sexual offences, which is a surprising thing, which we're now asking ourselves why. What is it? So we want to look into that in more detail as well. The last time we had that full data was in 2006, and then the conviction rates were about 45% of all courts on sexual offences. So it's an interesting phenomenon, so we can compare with them, but now we think it is because of the huge amount of training that has been done by SOCA in terms of upskilling our prosecutors, And a lot of awareness by our judiciary as well, which we think is, and also we now have a court preparation officer program where we actually assist we do focus a lot on the sexual offences cases. And we believe that all these interventions are actually now bearing a lot of fruit in terms of our prosecution of this case.
Honourable Steve Swart.
Thank you, Chair. And also from my side, very well done on the fact that you've now no longer got a qualified audit. It should be the norm, but we appreciate that there are improvements. But may I just ask a couple of issues around the finances? The 175 million Vyomint, if I understood correctly, you indicated that that was due to the OSD not being implemented because of the calculations that had to be made manually, and therefore it couldn't be paid in that particular year, but National Office had a problem, so you wanted to help National Office, the National Department, and that's the reason why you gave it. But surely, can I just, that obviously begs the question, when you gave it, you knew you had that debt that was looming. I would have loaned the National Department, but clearly you knew that you're going to run short the next year, because you've got this amount. 175, you now give it, now you're short of 175. Just logically, how did you think that through, that you were going to cover that shortfall for the next year? Then just the general comments that the Auditor General made, and you've dealt with a lot of the particular issues, but obviously at the end, the concerning statements, the matters of emphasis that he raises, you've dealt with almost all of them, but just the general comments about leadership. How are you going to address those? And I'm not directing to the DG yourself, DG, but I'm saying the accounting officers in general, where the comment is made, the leadership of the NPA did not exercise oversight responsibility over reporting, compliance with laws, regulations, and related internal controls. What are we doing to improve that? Secondly, management did not prepare regular, accurate, and complete financial reports that were supported and evidenced by reliable information.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, management did not review and monitor compliance with laws and regulations. So whilst we've now got no longer a qualified audit, which is great, obviously there's some serious questions that need to be asked about addressing those issues as at 31 July this year. And I'd like to just hear what we're going to hear next year to these aspects, to what degree they've been improved. Then the second range of issues which I've always raised is, and it's already largely been explained, the issues of the 2.8 million cases starting through and flowing through. Just one particular aspect on the stats, the crime stats, is the number of commercial crime cases finalized. And there's a huge red flag there, because we're all aware of what the internal dimensions of what's going on in that unit and the unhappiness. And it's now clearly portrayed in the reduction in the number of cases that have been finalized, where we've got 742 cases finalized, the target was 1465. But even if the target wasn't that high, last year we had 1,095 cases. And we know that unit is so crucial in the fight against corruption. The explanation given that you now in terms of are no longer going to outsource, can you further help me understand that? Surely that places even a greater burden on the existing staff members if you're not outsourcing. And yes, we understand budgetary constraints. That's probably the main motivation why you're not outsourcing, because it costs a lot. But now you are retaining the work. And let me just give you a practical example. I was a prosecutor for very initial years. My main, when I practiced law, was with the State Attorney's Office. It was 100%. But then to say, there was a huge issue around the cost of litigation and briefing advocates. And then it was decided that State Attorneys should, as far as possible, appear themselves and do the cases themselves. Now, that placed a huge pressure on the State Attorney's Office to start litigating cases in the High Court. Is this not a similar situation with the commercial crime cases? And did that not also contribute to the lower number of cases finalized? Maybe you can assist on that. The third issue is related to the asset forfeiture unit, which is very impressive. The short answer is yes. You remember what the question was? Use Chapter 6. That's obvious. use chapter 6, you ask for guidance, use chapter 6. We can't wait for lengthy criminal cases. Test it to its limit. But don't come to us in the trafficking bill and ask us to test the limits of litigation. You remember what happened there, and put in a whole lot of things there, because that seemed pushing the envelope a bit there. But I think that as Forfeiture Unit is doing an incredible job keeping it. The one aspect relating to the payments to victims, where you said it's reduced due to the nature of the cases. Now, interestingly, in the NPA's annual reports, they refer to a quite a large number of victims' payments that were made, which is quite commendable. That's on page 21. 1471 compensation orders were made, granted to victims of crime, and that's presumably in terms of section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act. And maybe you might not have details on that, but that would be interesting to follow up to what degree, the crisp question is, to what degree should section 300 be amended to broaden the scope for compensation orders for victims of crime? Now, that's a double-edged sword, because you already, your prosecutors are under huge pressure to finalize. Should they be doing more compensation orders? At the moment, it's only, if I remember correctly, for malicious damage to property that you can get compensation orders. But what about in a straightforward assault? What about in where straightforward issues, where at that point in the criminal case, you could ask, the prosecutor could ask for a compensatory order? Now, we're looking at that in the trafficking bill as well. But that is something that could help the victims of crime, and I'd like your comments on that. Then the last issue relates to the disciplinary issues. Could you just give me an indication, if a prosecutor, it's probably minimal, if a prosecutor is charged criminally, do you wait for the criminal trial to be finalized before you do the disciplinary action? And that's an issue which we've had in the Magistrates Commission continually, that debate. And maybe if you could just give me an answer to that. Thank you, Chair.
Perhaps I'll just start with the last one. No, we don't. In a disciplinary matter, the minute the prosecutor is charged, we immediately start with the disciplinary process. It's, of course, it's a matter which, well, all matters will require disciplinary proceeding. I can give an example recently of a prosecutor who is charged with murder. The trial hasn't even started. We've already done the disciplinary hearing, finalized it, and dismissed the person. So no, we definitely are not waiting, because as you know, Payments Act forfeiture, these processes can take a long time, and it's unnecessary for you to wait for that. It's already, you know, you have the docket, you can proceed, your evidentiary proof is much lower, as well as the probability, etc. So no, we don't wait for that.
Can we send the commission to you?
Yes, you can.
The Magistrates Commission.
You can send them to us, yeah.
maybe on that point, I mean, that's a separate issue, but the slow process with the magistrates' criminal matters, the magistrates are accused, can the NPA give us an undertaking? They will expedite matters in which magistrates are accused.
There's one that's been going for 4 years.
I mean, the magistrates are very skilled, because they've picked up from the accused that appeared before them in terms of finding reasons to ask for postponements, but maybe if they can just give us that undertaking.
We can give that undertaking, and through Africa Jiva and Mukhata's office, I'm sure we can issue some directive in terms of that to the prosecutors. In terms of the 175 million that was the environment to the Department of Justice, you correctly have summarised the position relating to the fact that we were unable to pay, and yes, it is so. At that stage, we did know that we would have a rollover and a commitment in the next year of about between 30 and 55 million. Unfortunately, the current situation of the Department of Justice is such that they are not in a position to give us any of that money back. I'm sure tomorrow when the DG presents, because I'm part of the EXCO, I'm aware of what the financial situation is like, she will be able to indicate to you. And as that is the national office, we know there's no way that we can ask them to do something which they simply can't. There's just no way that they can, although the DG would love to assist us. There's no way that she unfortunately can assist. No, it wasn't alone. It is the national department, and you know, we all one vote, etc. And rather than lose that money, because the lower court budget is paid by the Department of Justice. They provide us with the IT, the infrastructure, telephone, accounts for prosecutor usage, accommodation, etc., etc. So it wasn't like we're not going to get anything in return for what our agreement was with the department. In terms of the report of the Auditor General and the matter of emphasis, for us, as I indicated earlier, we have a comprehensive audit plan that will deal with the areas we in the past we have struggled with, you know, employee benefits, assets, and that's because, you know, it's something which you can easily lose a grip on if you don't keep a tight rein on it. So it does deal with that, but specifically all areas relating to emphasis of matter and relating to the big report that we get in this, every single one of those aspects, we have got an action plan to address. And to note that, you know, the wording that the Auditor General uses is prescribed wording relating to the fact that there's based on more findings. So, and it is something which you know, we have discussed with them, but it's important that those are the words that have to be used. So it creates the impression that there's no leadership, there's no control, but I can assure you that that is not the case, and that we are very, very strict on these areas. And within the NPA, any manager who makes him or herself guilty of any of these transgressions and non-delivery is dealt with speedily and swiftly. We are serious about making a difference. We are serious about addressing these areas. And we can show you the data. We've actually started to address these areas. So we will present. I can send out all the plan to you so you can have a look at it. And obviously, we will welcome any inputs where you feel that we can improve. There's always room for improvement. But our aim this year is to reduce the emphasis of matter as well as ensure that we maintain the unqualified audit.
Thank you.
Well, this is a follow-up. Yeah. Okay, I'll note you. Advocate Adams. Oh, yes, Section 300.
Yes.
Maybe I should just make one correction. The Section 300s are not only available when there's malicious damage to property. It's also a loss of property. But I think there has been a greater emphasis in the NPA to use Section 300 where there are victims of crime. The disadvantage of the Section 300 procedure is essentially that the person in whose favor the order is made must give up their right to claim civilly from the accused, which can be a problem in some cases. And the advantage of asset forfeiture is that where we do those cases, as the victim doesn't lose any right that they have to a civil judgment. Obviously, it may be taken into account when they sue from the person. But I think the concern in some of the cases has been that, you know, the accused may be without money now, so you get a very small amount of compensation, and then in a year's time, when they know they are free from any further civil litigation, the money comes out of hiding, and they do have money, but you no longer have a civil claim against that person because you've had to denounce it. So I think we often discuss with the prosecutors what the best mechanism is in those cases. And from our AFU point of view, we have limited resources, so we don't have the capacity to do asset forfeiture in favor of the victims too often. But I think a lot of the work that we're now doing in the anti-corruption task team, like the farms in KZN, essentially is going to be money, at least, that comes to government as a victim of these crimes. So, but, you know, I think those figures will start going up quite a lot for AFU in that area. But we just don't have the capacity at the moment to, you know, we're trying to do some balance between helping victims of crime in those kind of cases and dealing with more serious offences like your drug dealers, gold smugglers, whatever, which is to some degree our major priority.
Thank you, Chairperson. In general, I think that good progress has been made, apart obviously from the politics of the NPA that's in the newspapers. I'm very happy with the media and the communications unit. I've mentioned it to the acting CEO. I think they're doing a very good job. I concerned though that there are way too many inconsistencies in the annual report of this year and last year, but also in your presentation, and I will get to that now. For an example, if you look at the measurable objectives that you had for last year, specific reference was made to 2% increase year, 2% reduction year. The whole time it was 2%. This year there's no reference of the 2%. I don't know if it disappeared, but my question though is, how will this portfolio committee obviously monitor the objectives as mentioned in this annual report? Let me quickly go to that. Like you mentioned last year, increasing finalization of cases by 2%, increase alternative dispute resolution measures by 2%, improve capacity to deal with commercial crime with 2%. This year, it's just increase, and reduction. I would like to have a response on that. Another objective that you've raised in last year's annual report, which I thought I'm going to see in this year's, is that the Tutuzela care centres will be increased from, you specifically said, from 15 to 30. This year, you make reference to 27, and then you do indicate that you have exceeded the target. So from where is the 27 and the 30, and where is the 3 missing? There's also an objective to reduce the number, well, last year again, to reduce the number of witnesses walking off the witness protection program from 16 to 10%. This year, it just says to reduce the percentage. So again, my question is, how are we going to measure whether that percentage, because it could be 0.001%, and then you can say that you have in fact achieved that. Then I have a few questions, maybe things that I just don't understand. Like in the annual report last year, there were reference made about transfer payments, and then it was specifically said that transfer of payments is not applicable to the NPA. This year, on page 15, the NPA transferred 1.8 million to SACITA. My question to that is, when did it become applicable, and how did it become applicable? Then there's also, there was reference made to the SRM, the security, I don't know what's the real, the proper word, but I know it's security, investigated 333 reports of both financial and asset losses lodged within this year. I mean, within last year. This year, there's only reference made to 49 losses of state assets that were registered. So what happened to the other 200-odd reports? I have a question with regards to the audit committee. There is a specific member that I've noticed for two consecutive years are not attending the meetings very well, and this is Ms. Zodwa Manasseh. What is the NPA's response with regards to that? Because surely in 2 years' time she cannot attend only two committee meetings for the whole year. There are some SCOPA recommendations that seems to be the same as last year. Three senior managers were, disciplinary action were taken against three senior managers for 10-day irregularities. I don't know whether, no, there was no reference made now in the presentation as to what happened to those three senior managers. Also, final written warnings were issued to three senior managers with regard to irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure, but this year I thought at least we will get a response with regards to that. I also want clarity on the sale and leaseback transaction and whether it's still in existence. Then I have a question with regards to the case backlog project. Now, I have asked the NPA previously, what is the number per court, the number of cases that are backlog cases per court, and can one determine which court is really not pulling its weight. I am still waiting for a response on that. I also want to know whether there is a system that indicates the number of postponements with regards to those cases, so as to avoid a case where it can be postponed for 48 times. Then, last year it was indicated that there are 46 regional court backlog courts. This year it's 57. My question is, where are these courts? And can one actually see that there's at least some movement in those courts? Then there's this year reference made to 16 district courts. Again, my question is, where are those courts? I have also asked a question to the Minister of this department with regards to witness protection program, and his answers were quite interesting. I have asked him how many witnesses are in the witness protection program for longer than 24 months, which is 2 years' time. His response was 38. Now, if you look at the annual report on page 31, a lot of numbers are being made reference to. I've done my own calculations, and I have come to at least a difference of 195 witnesses that have been in the program for longer than 24 months. Now, my question is, where did the minister get his 38? Maybe you might not be able to answer me, but it does create a funny picture. I have also asked him what is the average cost to protect a witness per month. His specific reference was 17,541.44. Here in your annual report on page 31, you make reference to 27,700, which is almost 10,000 difference. Maybe somebody didn't do the math proper. But even further, I have asked the minister, how long is this witness protection program currently? He has indicated it has been reduced from 36 months to 15 months. But in your annual report, you make reference to 18 months. Again, it's a difference. Something else that he also mentioned, and I actually thought that Mr. Hoffman is going to make reference to it, he said that the NPA is in the process of fast-tracking cases that have witnesses in the witness protection program. Now, no reference was made to that, and there's also not even reference in the annual report about it, so which makes me wonder, is it the truth or is it not the truth? There's also, you have made reference about the indigenous languages at specific courts, but you have not elaborated on it as like last year, and I wonder whether these courts are still in existence, whether there has been progress, and whether it in fact did not affect, no, my question is, did it perhaps affect any appeal processes? Because if I know that when an indigenous language is used, if the matter goes to the Supreme Court of Appeal, I suppose it will have to be translated. And are we saying that in all these courts, none of these cases have actually been sent on appeal and need a translation? What happened to your adult diversion project? There was reference made to that. There was even a project launched at the Wentworth Court, and then there was another project, yeah, with Kulisa. What happened to it? I thought that you might talk about that. The Road Accident Fund project that you have also launched at the Pretoria Magistrates Court. There's a silence death with regards to that. On a little bit of a lighter note, the NPA intended to charge for tariffs with regards to photocopies. This year, reference is now made that they intend to charge for parking. Was it a typing error? Or are they still planning to charge for parking and photocopying? Or only parking or only photocopying? And then my last question, the IMU unit launched a hotline that was open for 24 hours where members of the NPA can report wrongdoing or transgressions or things like that. Does it still exist? And what is the hotline number? Thank you.
Members, some members are giving me signals, what looks at their watches. We'll stop at 1, okay, and then start again at 2. Is that okay? All right. Who's answering Advocate Adams?
Responsible to, in terms of, let's put it in, actually DOJ committee, which we contemplate.
unlikely that the minister's answer cover the same period that we are talking about. So I think what we can undertake is to try and reconcile those figures for you. But it's difficult. We don't know whether the minister's answer dealt with the same period that we are talking about. Yeah.
In 2008, the 9 period, there were 218 witnesses. The year thereafter, there were 398 witnesses, which is a difference of 108. This year, there are 203, okay, which is a difference of negative 195. But either way, it doesn't come close to the 38. And even if you calculate it, the 203, yeah, from the 398, there's at least 180 that one can question. But the 180 you mentioned in your report, you mentioned something about the 180 in your report. I just can't find it now. But it's not 38. And 17,000 rand is not 27,000 rand. And then my million-dollar question is whether the NPA is fast-tracking these cases where the witnesses are involved.
As I say, I think we'd have to look, but I think it's important to understand that there is a significant amount of witnesses who come on and off the program continuously. So, you know, many people are not there even for the whole year. So they come on during the year, they leave during the year, so they may not be captured at the year end points and so on. So, you know, so we do have a method of calculating what we say is the average number of people, and we do have the figures we give for the year-end figures. But during the year, the fluctuations, even within the year, the numbers fluctuate on the program quite significantly. On the fast tracking, you know, that is something that we are doing. We're not trying to pull the wool over your eyes. But obviously, you know, these are still criminal matters that are stuck in the courts, and it's ultimately a presiding officer that decides how fast the trial proceeds. So what we're trying to do is, to the extent that we can, liaise with the directors of public prosecutions and the actual prosecutors assigned to those cases in each jurisdiction, is just to see what it is that can be done to avoid unnecessary delays. And to the extent that these witnesses can be called earlier rather than later in the trial, and those sorts of issues. And, you know, that's essentially, partly it's related to the cost of having people on the program, but also it is obviously significant disruption of the lives of the witnesses the longer they stay on the program. Karen's looking for the hotline now.
I'll get to that too, sorry. The IMU hotline number is 0800-212-580. But we have gone out on tender again for this. So right now it's not operational, but we are in the process of finalizing the contract, and it will be operational again. Your question in terms of the parking was whether we were going to charge a parking for the prosecutors who are staff. Is that the question?
There's no specific reference to who the NPA will charge. It just says the NPA intends charging for parking, and previously it was parking in policy. So I can't say whether it's for the NPA, whether it's for...
This relates to a policy that we are developing at the moment. It is before the Bargaining Council, and that relates to the fact that we believe that it is correct to charge personnel a nominal fee for parking. Where it is at NPA premises, this is the norm in government that people do pay. We have for a long period of time not been compliant, and so we want to become compliant in that regard. It is not going to be market-related prices, you know, the 1,800 that people pay in other places. But we are busy, as I say, it's not finalized because we're still busy negotiating this with the union. And then we will finalize. So this will apply to everybody. Yeah.
Good Adams. Can we hold over on the response with regard to the audit committee member until we get back from lunch? Is that okay with you? Thank you. All right. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, I'm told we don't come back here. Regrettably, it's in M46. It's on the ground floor. It's on the ground floor in Marksburg.